Chapter 4. The Texan Bowl Game. Finally, game day had arrived, and Dave, Juan, and Mac had been planning their Texan Bowl adventure for over a month. It was around noon, and Dave was just about to leave his house when Julie reminded him to take his coat, because it was supposed to be cooler later that evening. As Dave closed his front door with coat in hand, his neighbor, Juan, was already waiting by Dave's car in the driveway, with a big grin and sporting a University of Colorado cap on his head. "I'm free," Dave said with excitement and a big smile, then added, "Let's get out of here quick, before Julie finds another chore for me to do." Juan eagerly replied, "So let's hit the road, right now," as they climbed into the car and made their escape. While they made their way driving out of the neighborhood, Dave was happy to proclaim, "I have my manager, Philip, heading things up at the restaurant today and tomorrow, so I'm on vacation for at least a couple of days."
"That's great," Juan replied. "You work a lot of hours. It's important that give yourself time off to have fun."
Then Juan added with a big smile, "I don't have to go back to the police station until Monday, after New Year's Day." Dave said, "I called Mac just a little bit ago and he said he is ready, and set to go."
Juan gave a nod and replied, "Good, there's nothing to stop us now."
After picking up Mac, the car was filled with animated chatter and friendly banter, followed up by a lively mix of sports predictions. Their next destination, a local sports bar, a pre-game pit stop before heading to the stadium. From there, a quick rideshare would transport them to the heart of the action, the Alamo Sports Center, where the excitement of the game awaited. A different kind of excitement was brewing for Julie back at the Johnson house. Juan's wife, Maria, and Mac's wife, Abby, were coming over for a wives' party, and to watch the Texan Bowl on TV. The house was already filled with the aroma of delicious food cooking, and Julie was making her final preparations before the arrival of her friends. For sure, there would absolutely be plenty of wine on the menu as well. At about the same time, Violet is working out in the gym at the fire station before her shift was to begin. After warming herself up by lifting weights, she put on boxing gloves and walked over to the heavy punching bags. Although, a lot of the other firemen frequently worked out on the punching bags, recognizing the limitations of the existing equipment, Violet had taken the initiative to install a second punching bag, a strategic addition that catered to her unique training style. Violet liked to work both punching bags at the same time. She began with a series of lighter strikes, her feet finding their rhythm as she alternated between the targets. With each passing moment, her movements gained momentum, her punches growing harder, her kicks more powerful and precise. Her movements were like a choreographed dance, a symphony of punches and kicks, impacts that flowed seamlessly between the two bags. Gradually, she increased the speed and power of her punches, and began delivering a wide variety of kicks. Eventually she opened up, and she unleashed a massive barrage of kicks and punches, each one with carefully executed technique, a testament to her mastery of martial arts. With every strike, Violet's body danced a graceful ballet of violence. Rocky, the station's captain, walked into the room and stood at the doorway watching. Rocky Thompson was in charge of the fire station. He was a well-seasoned fireman with over 32 years of experience. With gray hair, he was tall with a solid build, and conveyed authority. Many of the firemen thought that he might eventually be promoted someday to fire chief. At this stage of her workout, Violet's pounding was shattering each bag, wildly shaking the chains that held them in place. From spin kicks, followed up by punches and elbows to each bag, she maintained her flurry. After watching her ferociously maul the punching bags for a bit, Rocky interrupted, yelling out to get her attention, "Hey Violet!" Breathing heavily, Violet stopped and stood there glaring at a bag, with a crazed wild look on her face. Rocky announced, "We have a staff meeting in the meeting room at 2 o'clock, that's a little over 30 minutes from now, be there." Violet slowly looked over at Rocky and nodded her head. The captain started to leave the room, but then turned back and said, "Violet, you can be scary sometimes, but I'm glad you're on our side." Then he left the room. Violet, now showered and refreshed from her intense workout, slipped into her uniform and made her way to the meeting room. As she entered, the meeting room was abuzz with conversations. Sam was entertaining a group of firefighters, describing tales of his explosive encounter the night before. The captain's voice cut through the chatter. "All right, everyone,
let's settle down. We're starting this meeting promptly. The San Antonio Police Department will be presenting to us via video conference. The police chief has some important information about the explosion last night, and he wants to share with all the fire stations in town. He'll be coming on the screen shortly. A hush fell over the room, as everyone quickly found a seat. Sam and Violet sat next to each other, both of them, anxious to hear about what the police had to say about the explosion. The captain began the meeting, saying, "I'm sure you've all heard about the suspected suicide vest explosion that took place last night. If it weren't for Sam's experience and decisive action, we could have been dealing with a much more tragic situation. So, I want to give a special thank you to Sam. Let's all give Sam a round of applause for his exceptional bravery and decisive action." The room erupted in applause, a well-deserved tribute to Sam's heroism. The captain continued, saying, "As we move forward, we need to be even more vigilant and observant. Police Chief Thompson will be joining us shortly. He hopes to provide crucial information that will help us protect ourselves and the public from these kinds of threats." As the captain spoke, the large screen TV in the room was on, but the online presentation had not started yet. "So, while we wait for the police chief to join us," Rocky said, turning his attention to Sam and Violet, he asked, "A couple of weeks ago, you two were assigned to the Alamo Sports Center for tonight's game. Given the events of last night, if either of you feel uncomfortable with the assignment, I can find replacements if you need a break." Sam was quick to respond, "No, sir, I'm good to go." Violet echoed his sentiment, saying, "I'm fine too. I have no problem with working the Alamo Center tonight. It should be an easy gig, I got this." The captain gave an affirmative nod, and replied, "Okay then, and both of you also volunteered for the Military Service Bowl assignment on New Year's Day. I assume that's still a go?" Sam and Violet exchanged a glance before nodding in agreement. The captain responded with a grin, "Great, that makes my life easy." Sam's and Violet's commitment to serving their community remained unwavering, even in the face of a new potential danger, plus the overtime pay feels good too. Just then, the TV went live with the police, the camera centered on a distinguished mature man, and he immediately began the video conference. "Hello everyone, my name is Ben Thompson, Chief of the San Antonio Police Department. To my right is Detective Frank Benson, and to my left is Detective Sophia Jones." Sam and Violet recognized Frank and Sophia from the chaotic night before. After introductions were complete, the police chief proceeded with the purpose of the meeting. "I'm going to give you an update regarding the explosion that took place on the east side of San Antonio last night." Chief Thompson's voice was strong and carried a sense of authority as he continued. "Frank and Sophia are heading up the investigation of this explosion. Based on the account of a San Antonio Fire Department EMT, available video footage, and an assessment of the San Antonio Bomb Squad, we believe the explosion was caused by what is commonly called a suicide vest. Prior to the vest being detonated, it was being transported in a 2007 Nissan Altima, laying horizontally on the back seat of the vehicle. It was not being worn at the time of detonation." The chief's narrative painted a picture of a high-speed police chase that ended in a car crash as he continued speaking. "Two men, unconscious and trapped inside the vehicle, were the focus of the emergency responders and the on-site police officers. Paramedic Samuel Harris spotted the vest on the back seat and immediately recognized the deadly nature of the device. Upon hearing Sam's name mentioned by the police chief, the fireman sharing the meeting room with Sam acknowledged his new fame, along with a few thumbs up." The police chief continued his narrative, adding, "As the paramedics and police scrambled to assess the situation, the car burst into flames. EMT Samuel Harris immediately issued a warning, alerting police and other emergency personnel in the area to the imminent danger of the suicide vest. Thanks to the vigilance of Samuel Harris, everyone quickly evacuated the scene and took cover. Shortly after, the vest detonated." All the people in the meeting room with Sam once again acknowledged his heroism with a shout-out and applause. The chief emphasized a crucial detail, saying, "It's important to note that the vest was positioned horizontally on the back seat at the time of the explosion. This orientation significantly reduced the deadly force of the blast. Had it been worn and positioned vertically, the shrapnel would have been projected outward in all directions, likely causing serious injuries or fatalities." As the police chief continued to speak, the display on the screen changed away from him to high-resolution slide images, providing a visual aid to his explanations. A wave of interest rippled through the crowd, with everyone leaning forward in their chairs. Attendees exchanged curious glances, eager to absorb the visual information being presented. The police chief's voice continued, providing narration to the slides. This is what a suicide vest typically looks like. The concept is, there are numerous explosive charges and metal shrapnel, sewn into position, between two layers of fabric. Similar to insulation being sewn into a winter coat. The explosion is commonly triggered by the wearer holding a handheld trigger. For most suicide vests, the trigger utilized is a release trigger, which detonates when the wearer releases the trigger. A safety pin, inserted in the trigger mechanism, prevents detonation until after the pin is pulled out. Another type of trigger, referred to as a positive action trigger, has a button that the wearer pushes to instantly detonate, which also requires a safety pin to be pulled out. With both types of triggers, when a vest is detonated, steel shrapnel radiates out horizontally in all directions, with severe and deadly consequences. The slideshow offered step-by-step, detailed diagrams and animations, illustrating the functionality of what the police chief was describing. The attendees watched with a mixture of fascination and horror, as the chief explained the device's inner workings. As emergency responders, the possibility of encountering a suicide vest on any call was an unsettling realization. The chief explained, "The vest that detonated last night was fortunately positioned horizontally. This meant that a lot of the blast force and shrapnel were directed upwards into the sky and downwards towards the ground. Had it been worn vertically, or even positioned on the back seat vertically, the consequences would have been far more devastating." Sam leaned over toward Violet and whispered, "He's right. If either of those guys were wearing that vest, we might be dead." The TV screen went back to a live view of the police chief speaking. "As an emergency responder, if you see a suicide vest, there are only three things you can do. 1. Get far away as fast as you can. 2. Hide behind something solid. 3. Sound the alarm for others to get away by yelling the word bomb, over and over. But, above all, get away as fast as you can. It is always best to put space between you and a bomber, and when you're at a safe distance, wait for a police officer to confront the bomber. For now, all I want you to do is be vigilant. If you see something, say something. Whatever you do, don't confront someone you think is a bomber. You might be wrong, and possibly cause harm to that person, or, you might wind up dead. Right now, we don't have much to go on, but the FBI is getting involved. We can only hope and pray that the suicide vest that detonated last night was the only vest in town. Thank you for attending this meeting, and be safe." The meeting concluded, leaving a lasting impression on everyone, and a realization that their jobs may have just gotten a whole lot more dangerous. After the meeting, Sam and Violet went out to the equipment bay to finish preparing their ambulance. Once they finished their prep work, they would be heading off to the stadium. They were scheduled to be on call at the stadium till 10 p.m. that night, so they were bringing a cooler with food and drinks for themselves. The stadium had reserved parking for their ambulance, which was just outside the on-site first aid station within the stadium. If they weren't transporting somebody to the hospital, they were expecting to be at the first aid station for the next 7 hours, and it was now time to head off to the stadium. The trio of Dave, Mac, and Juan just stepped into the bustling sports bar. The air was filled with the aroma of sizzling food and the sound of people having a good time. A friendly hostess greeted them, leading them to a table tucked away in a corner. As they settled into their seats, a pretty waitress with stunning red flowing hair approached. Her smile was friendly and as bright as the neon lights that adorned the bar. "Can I get you started with something to drink?" she cheerfully asked. The guys knew each other well, and after exchanging glances, Dave replied, "A pitcher of dark beer, please." His voice firm, and Juan and Mac nodded with agreement. The waitress jotted down their order, promising to return shortly. As a serving platter full of sizzling burgers and fries passed by their table, the sound and aroma was overwhelmingly inviting, inspiring the guys to immediately know what they wanted to eat. Eventually, the guys had finished eating, and after downing several glasses of beer each, they were feeling festive and having a good time watching sports on TV. Feeling inspired, Dave decided to do the French fry on the shoulder game. Speaking softly, Dave said, "Watch this, guys, I do this with my grandkids all the time." Holding his hand out towards Juan, he asked, "Juan, can I have one of your leftover French fries? Make it a big one." Dave took one of Juan's largest leftover fries and placed it on his shoulder. Then he explained, "There's this thing I do, and I've done this with my grandkids a lot. For some reason, waitresses never say anything about me putting a French fry on my shoulder. In fact, I'm so sure she won't say anything, if she mentions anything at all about the French fry on my shoulder. I promise, I will double her tip." With mischievous smiles, Mac and Juan sat back and silently watched Dave play his game. The waitress came back to the table and asked if the men needed anything else. Juan and Mac noticed the waitress glancing at the French fry, but she said nothing. Dave drew the waitress's attention to him by answering, "I think we're finished, we'll take the bill now." The waitress collected each of their plates, which took a few moments, prolonging the French fry suspense. Then, as if nothing was out of the ordinary, she said that she would be back with the bill, but she still had said nothing about the French fry. She may have seen it, but she gave no hint that she noticed it. As she walked away, it was all the guys could do to contain their laughter. Dave leaned forward and whispered, "See, what did I tell you? They never say anything about the French fry on my shoulder. Not ever. And I've played the French fry game many times." Just like his grandkids, Mac and Juan were utterly astonished and playfully entertained. Dave added, "You know she must have seen it, but for some reason she was afraid to mention it." As they prepared to leave, Dave asked Mac to call for a rideshare for the next leg of their adventure, to the Alamo Center, and Juan got up to make a trip to the restroom. But instead of going to the restroom, Juan discreetly caught up with their waitress, just as she came out of the kitchen. He asked her, "Did you happen to notice the big French fry on my friend's shoulder?" The waitress smiled, "I saw it, but I didn't know what to say about it. I thought perhaps one of you other guys put it there to play a joke on him." Then she asked with a mischievous look, "So what's up with the French fry?" Juan told her all about Dave's game. Then he asked, "Will you do me a favor? When you bring the bill to the table, have a French fry on your shoulder also. My friend will really get a kick out of that." She replied with a fun giggle, "Okay, sounds like fun." With the plan for the French fry game, counterattack, in place, Juan returned back to the table and anxiously awaited her return. Sure enough, when she came to the table with the bill, she had a really big French fry on her shoulder. When Dave saw the waitress's French fry, he was ecstatic. "I can't believe it, you win," he said to the waitress. "You are the first person to literally beat me at the French fry game." They were all laughing, and so were the people at the table on the opposite side of the aisle, who had overheard the entire French fry discussion. Dave proclaimed to the waitress, "For getting the best of me with my French fry game, you'll be getting an extra big tip." Dave was true to his word, and their table was an extra good table for the waitress that day. After the bill was paid, Dave and his friends exited the sports bar to catch their rideshare to the stadium. On their way out, Dave politely held the door open for several people coming in. One of them was Carlos Mendoza. Like ships passing each other in the night, the chance meeting of these men as they passed through the same doorway was a pure coincidence. While Dave and his friends were leaving for the stadium to watch the bowl game, Carlos and his associate were entering that same restaurant to watch the same bowl game on TV. Carlos asked the hostess for a table that had a good view of a TV, one that was going to broadcast the bowl game. The hostess said that starting 30 minutes prior to the game, all the TVs in the restaurant will have the game on, which fit Carlos's needs perfectly. The United States of America is regarded by the rest of the world as a safe haven, free from the dangers that plague many nations. American citizens live their lives with a kind of naive innocence because they feel so historically safe. Notably, San Antonio is a very civilized and safe city, especially during the holiday season. When the city hosts major sporting events, there is always a strong police presence to ensure safety. However, adversaries of America now have an increased ability and the radical desire and support of foreign governments to penetrate into America in greater numbers and bring their chaos with them. Carlos Mendoza represents just one such adversary, and is part of a larger coordinated effort intended to purposely inflict extreme violence against American citizens, intentions that would soon, once again, terrify a nation. Now on station at the Alamo Center's first aid station, Sam and Violet had familiarized themselves with the station and the available resources. Their mission was clear: to provide immediate assistance to any fans or players who required medical attention, and if necessary, transport them to a nearby hospital. The stadium was well prepared to handle minor medical emergencies, with a dedicated in-house medical staff and plenty of healthcare supplies at their disposal. In addition to Sam and Violet, a second ambulance crew was stationed at the first aid station, also ready to respond to critical situations. To help pass the time and alleviate the stress of their duties, the first aid station featured a comfortable designated EMT waiting area, equipped with a television tuned to the game. For the ambulance crews, it was a small escape from the intensity of their work, a chance to unwind and catch a glimpse of the football action. The in-house medical staff and EMTs were familiar faces to each other, having worked together at many previous events. While they hoped their services wouldn't be needed, they were prepared to provide the best possible care to anyone who required it. At the Johnson home, it was around 3:30 p.m., and Julie was in the process of putting the finishing touches on a taco buffet, with festive music playing on the entertainment system. With the ring of the doorbell, Maria arrived at the front door bearing homemade avocado dip, chips and fancy crackers, and two bottles of fine wine. Julie was quick to provide assistance to Maria, finding a place on the kitchen table for the food she had brought. Julie remarked with eager eyes, "Maria, your chunky avocado dip looks absolutely delicious, like a work of art." Maria replied, "I think you'll really like it. It's the best batch I've made in a long time, the avocados are extra tasty." Then after breathing in a deep breath, Maria added, "Oh boy, your tacos smell really good, I can hardly wait." Not long after, Abby arrived, her hands full of delectable desserts. In one hand she had a festively decorated football-shaped bowl game cake, and in the other hand, a container of assorted homemade chocolate cookies. While Julie helped her place the desserts on the table, Maria was pouring a glass of wine for each of them. The wives' party was about to get into full swing. Spirits were high with anticipation, and the girls were all set for a cozy football party of their own, complete with more food than they could possibly consume. After Maria presented everyone with a glass of wine, she proposed a thrilled and delighted toast: "Here's to the true meaning of football, a whole lot of good food, and of course, good wine." With the clink of their glasses, their party had officially started. After running the gauntlet of getting from the sports bar to their seats in the Alamo Center, Dave, Juan, and Mac were settling in. Their vantage point was prime, a spot near the 50-yard line, midway up the stadium. Dave was thrilled and said to his friends, "Guys, today, right now in these seats, is the best place to be in the whole wide world, and we get to do it together." Everyone agreed and they shared a fist bump. A couple of minutes later, Dave announced, "Hey guys, it's time for a group selfie to send to the wives." They huddled together, and then with Dave's direction, everyone gave a thumbs up. With a click of the phone, their football ecstasy moment was captured, along with the enthusiastic photobombs from the fans behind them. It was perfect timing. The game was set to start soon, and the guys were in place. This year, a team from Austin, Texas, and a team from Florida made it to this bowl game. Although it was not a game that was going to lead to the national championship, for the guys, it was all about rooting for their favorite team from Texas, making this the biggest game of the year. As the game unfolded, it was a captivating spectacle that kept the guys anything but quiet and on the edge of their seats. Mac, in particular, was a fountain of witty remarks. His commentary was a constant source of amusement for those around them. Together, they formed an entertaining trio, their collective energy a welcome addition to the crowd. During the game, the guys indulged in a classic stadium experience, eating delicious stadium food and drinking canned beer. With a hot dog in one hand and a beer in the other, they fueled their passion for the game, and their spirits soared with every touchdown or defensive stop made by the Texas team. Back at the Johnson residence, the women were enjoying a feast of their own, their glasses repeatedly clinking together as they savored the delicious food and wine. As the TV cameras scanned the crowd, they were hoping to catch a glimpse of their husbands at the game, but were without luck. They knew about where their husbands would be seated, but the stadium was full, and with so many faces, seeing their husbands seemed impossible, like searching for a needle in a haystack. As the evening wore on, the wives began to slow down, with their appetites satisfied, and their bodies relaxing into the plush comfort of the reclining couch. The initial excitement of the party was replaced by a sense of contentment, and a quiet enjoyment of each other's company. Midway into the third quarter, a Texas player suffered a serious leg injury, serious enough to require immediate advanced medical attention. A transport decision was made, necessitating an ambulance transport to the hospital. Sam and Violet received notification, and their roles as EMTs shifted into high gear. The injured player was carefully transported to the ambulance station, via the stadium's medical cart, with his leg immobilized. Sam and Violet were waiting with their equipment ready. With precision and care, the player was strapped onto the ambulance stretcher. His extreme discomfort was evident. Their destination was the closest hospital, a mere 4-mile drive away. Sam and Violet's mission was clear: transport the injured player to the local hospital, and then return to the stadium. Accompanying Sam in the cab was a representative from the team to ensure the player's well-being and provide necessary updates back to the team. Violet would provide care for the player in the patient compartment. The ambulance departed with its emergency lights flashing, bound for University Hospital, a drive that would take approximately 8 minutes. However, what started out as a typical medical transport mission for Sam and Violet was about to evolve into a national historic event, something nobody could have anticipated. Surprise is an instrument often used by evil, an approach to avoid being stopped by good people. Tonight, evil would raise its head, and righteous people were about to be caught completely off guard. Trusting and unaware, they never saw it coming.